Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Channel 7 investigative reporter Charlie Specht, our in-studio guest right now. Charlie, one man has been removed, but what about the others? You brought this up yesterday in the news conference to Bishop Scharfenberger. What about Auxiliary Bishop Grosch and others?
You know, Bishop Malone's supporters have always said everything is not his fault, and they're right. You know, while he, you know, really is responsible, you know, a culture starts from the top down. There were a lot of people who had a hand in this over many years, probably none more so than Bishop Grosch. Some of the documents, and it's not just him being in that position, some of the documents that we've seen about the priests have his handwritten notes all over it, and has been sort of managing these priest files and been in charge of a group of priests called unassignable priests for many years. So people are wondering, what about him? Is he going to be? We actually had two web stories ready to go yesterday morning, one saying Bishop Malone has resigned and one saying Bishop Malone and Bishop Grosch has resigned, because we had heard that that may be a possibility. So when we asked Bishop Scharfenberger about this, he said that we asked him because he had said, oh, yeah, you know, thankfully Bishop Ed, he called him, is going to stay on and help us. But, you know, I think a lot of people, our readers and you know, viewers were asking me, what about him? Is he going to have any sort of accountability? He is set to retire in February anyway. And on some of those Malone recordings, even though we didn't make this public, you can hear him saying, I'm counting down the weeks until my retirement here. So, you know, we are told that, you know, he's probably going to ride this out. But Bishop Scharfenberger did say if there's, you know, evidence that he was part of this and that he was doing, you know, the wrong thing and could still be in a position to do that, that he would look into it. And I would also say that some of Bishop Malone's advisors are coming now into the crosshairs of the state and federal investigations here. So if you're building a case, you know, either fraud or racketeering, you're looking at many years of activities in the diocese. And our sources tell us that there have been a lot of questions on that end from the investigators about Bishop Grosch and his role here.
Now, wondering if you were able to maybe read between the lines or get any sense of how forthcoming Scharfenberger was when answering that question about Bishop Grosch. Because I think you have two maybe camps of people. One who would say, well, yeah, he's been here for, what, 24 hours? He probably doesn't have a handle on everything, and give him some time to gather some information and do what needs to be done. And then there's probably another group who says, well, how could you not know? Albany's not that far away. Buffalo's been in the news. You know, how could you not know about his involvement to everything that's gone on here?
Yeah, it's tough to say, to get inside the guy's head, but I guess we'll have to print out some of our stories and mail them to him so that he can get up to speed. You know, certainly Bishop Scharfenberger is coming at things from a different point of view than Bishop Malone is. I want to read a few lines here from a letter that Bishop Scharfenberger wrote to the clergy in Albany about a month before the scandal broke here in Buffalo. And this was right after Cardinal Theodore McCarrick of Washington was caught in all these allegations of misconduct. And he took a lot of criticism from this, Bishop Scharfenberger did, from clergy, because he was very direct. And he says here that the abuse is despicable and that really the bishops are, you know, just as culpable. He says their credibility is shot, you know, in the eyes of most people in the pews. He says he never understood why bishops were not included in the 2002 sex abuse reforms, that it only applied to priests. And then he says, and this is really interesting from the point of view of being different from Bishop Malone, he says, lawyering, pledges, and changes in the bureaucratic structures and policy, however well-intentioned, cannot repair the damage that has been done here. And those are the type of institutional kind of responses. You know, we're going to create a committee, we're going to create a commission, we're going to put out a new policy about adult misconduct. that's what the Buffalo Diocese has tried to do. And he's saying here, look, this is not a matter of policy. There's plenty of policies in place. The Buffalo Diocese has had a policy on sexual abuse since 1992. So it's not a matter of not having something on a piece of paper. It's how is it being enforced and, you know, is it being followed? So he's coming at it from a completely different point of view in that he is readily admitting, yeah, you know what? We are wrong. Bishops have been making the wrong decisions here. We need to really, you know, sort of get our house in order here because we're losing credibility here.
What about Bishop Malone? Will he have a future role with the diocese? Because if you read his statement yesterday, he says he intends to continue to live among you as Bishop Emeritus and to be available to serve you in whatever ways our apostolic administrator and new bishop determines is best. What do you think he means by that?
So that is kind of standard protocol for retired bishops. There have only been six now bishops and cardinals in the United States that have had to resign over sex abuse scandals, and they've all technically been a bishop emeritus or been able to retire. So basically, a bishop is allowed to, no matter how he leaves, is allowed to sort of retire and live in, you know, pretty nice quarters. Maybe not in the bishop's mansion, but he'll probably live somewhere like Bishop Kimmick, for instance. Bishop Malone's predecessor lives in a really nice place in St. Joseph's Cathedral Rectory. And that's kind of, bishops tend to retire to whatever diocese they last served. And they don't really, you know, make any great public appearances. They really kind of, similar to Pope Benedict does with Pope Francis, they kind of stay out of the spotlight. But, you know, they'll go to confirmations occasionally and that sort of thing. So I think Bishop Malone is kind of clinging to that kind of thing. And Siobhan O'Connor had said that maybe that was a motivation for Bishop Malone hanging on so long, because he thought that, you know, there was a chance that if he was sort of fired or forced to resign, that he wouldn't be able to stay, you know, and do that sort of thing. But I think practically speaking, he's probably not likely to spend a ton of time here. You know, it seemed like half the time that something was breaking out here in the diocese, we would call and he's in Cape Cod. He owns a home in Cape Cod with Father Paul Michelli, who is another priest, who is actually the priest personnel secretary for Cardinal Bernard Law, was heavily implicated in the Boston scandal. They're friends, and they own a place on Cape Cod where Bishop Malone is today. So, you know, he may spend as much time as he wants there. Now, you have to think the new bishop is not necessarily going to be bending over backwards to tie himself to Bishop Malone here. So mm-hmm. That could really mean a lot of nothing. If I were Bishop Malone, you know, not sure that I would want to be making a ton of public appearances. At least right now, he's you know, polls have shown he's extremely unpopular in the diocese. But people are sort of outraged, saying, why does he get his retirement? Similar to like a politician, if they have to step down, if they lose their pension, if they're convicted of a crime. That is just the system that the Catholic Church has in place. And you know, this is sort of business as usual for a retiring bishop.
We are in studio with Charlie Specht from Channel 7 on what really is a new day for the Buffalo Diocese. And Charlie, you know, I want to start with this time. There has been very little said about previous bishops who were in this diocese while all of this activity was going on. When we were talking about this, it's been going on for decades. Bishop Kimmick, Bishop Mansell, both are still living. Bishop Head no longer with us, but is there anything that could come of possible charges or something else with them?
Yeah, there is a very good possibility here that they could be mentioned in whatever federal case. Not that they would necessarily be charged. I suppose they could be. Any of us could be. But if there is some sort of report out or indictment or something, they could be mentioned as a sort of the historical, you know, men here who perpetuated these, you know, these cover-ups. Buffalo really kind of pulled off the greatest cover-up in the history of the church here, because, you know, it even surpassed Boston in the sense that it stayed quiet after Boston. Boston broke in 2003. There were dioceses around the country that, you know, hundreds who exploded with this abuse, but they were able to keep it under wraps here. They did such a good job sort of keeping it quiet. We went through some old records from Bishop Mansell's administration, and we were able to find that okay, after Boston, the Buffalo Diocese took four or five priests, kind of the admitted, you know, pedophiles here, many of the worst cases here, Father Orselitz, Father Donald Becker, who denied some of them, but he's got like 15 child abuse lawsuits filed against him right now. So men that they knew was a major problem here. And three or four of them all retired on the same day in 2003. So it was almost like you wonder, hey, were they sitting there saying, hey, we've got to get rid of these guys before somebody finds out on us? You know, what's going to happen here?
And 2003 is when Boston was all developing, right?
Right, exactly.
Wow. All right. And the FBI, you're mentioning this. We know the FBI has been looking into the diocese, but what is the status? Do you have any indication of when they may come with something?
So they don't talk about their investigations, but some of our sources have told us that, you know, they've really fanned out here. I mean, last year, I'm talking 6-7 months ago, they had already completed 200 plus interviews of different, you know, victims and individuals across the diocese. So, you know, this is not a case where they're just saying, oh, yeah, we're going to look into this, and it sort of fizzles out. You know, sometimes that does happen. They hit dead ends. Some of my stories have resulted in FBI investigations, and you never hear anything, you know, ever again. There's no charges. This seems like something where they're sort of convinced that there's a lot here. There's something here. Now, if they're building a federal racketeering case, racketeering laws, the RICO statute, was, you know, created to prosecute the mafia. So you'd have to think that it's going to be tough for them to make that case, because you're talking about charging the Catholic Church with crimes under a law, going after, you know, mobsters. I mean, that is a high bar, and you would think that, you know, somebody in Washington would have to approve that. So they're going to have to make a tough case. It's not a set thing. But they are, from what we have heard, very dedicated to this investigation. From the time frame, we heard it could be, you know, wrapped up, at least the investigating part of it, by the end of the year. But then that was before all of these other scandals, you know, broke here. So who knows? I would say we won't see anything likely by the end of the year.
What, in your opinion, was the tipping point for Rome to move, like, as you mentioned earlier, with lightning speed here? What maybe single event or couple of events here happened?
So it was the second wave here. You know, we have a second whistleblower here. I mean, this is unprecedented for two secretaries of a bishop to come out and say, morally, I can't take it anymore. I've got to do something. And then I think, you know, the publicity with the Nightline story this year generated, we can't forget about the two seminarians who stood up. I mean, you've got two seminarians in Roman collars standing out there in front of the diocese, you know, calling the bishop a criminal. I mean, this is like unprecedented in the Catholic Church here. That you know, raised. So you've got all the situations with Siobhan O'Connor that was sort of, you know, had been burning here for about a year. Then you have these seminarians coming out. The seminary is a complete mess. Then you have audio recordings of the bishop. People in the chancery are recording the bishop because they're so convinced that he's doing bad things. And then you have the bishop on tape in his own voice, sort of saying, oh, we've got to keep this, you know, under wraps, and this could be it for me, and I might have to resign, and, you know, please don't tell the press about this and everything. And it was, I think then, you know, Rome was like, you know, we've got to do something. I had heard from, we talked with some Vatican journalists. Rocco Palmo was telling us that there's some other bishops that he is in touch with across the country, and they were exasperated. They're like, when is Rome going to do something about Buffalo? Because it's making them all look bad. Essentially, they're judged by the worst example among them altogether. So they were really impatient, saying, you know, something has to be done here in this diocese. And finally, you know, sort of the institution kicked in here and moved pretty quickly.
Yeah, and here we are today. Charlie, I appreciate your time very much.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.